Okay.
Ms. Al, now that's what we're discussing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know where to go?
Mm-hmm. I thought I know you're going to town.
Yeah. And then we ask last time.
Shall we get started? Okay. Okay. Is this a group? This is not a group meeting?
No. Very
hard to meet. Okay. Hi, welcome everybody. My name is Danny. I'm a recovered alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. And thank you for having me here. I didn't know what to expect. Could have been two or three people sitting together in a room, or I didn't, you know, she didn't tell me anything. So she didn't tell me there were sandwiches, that's for sure. But I'm eating my Italian sandwich. I'll give my usual disclaimer. I'm not an AA historian or an expert on AA history or anything like that. I'm just a drunk who took an interest in learning as much as I could about AA and where I came from, where it came from, and therefore where I come from, and I identify with a lot of the people in our background and history. So I always hated history when I was a kid, and frankly, I hate it now. but it is AA, and it's important to me. It's one of my passions, and so all any of you true AA archivists and historians out there, please cut me a little slack because I don't talk about dates and, you know, 1935 and Mother's Day and all that stuff. Some of them I remember, some of them I really don't. She thinks I'm dyslexic. Maybe it had something to do with it. I don't know. But because I came to Parking Field number 6, looking for room number 4. And they looked at me like, and there was all these big, you know, athletic guys walking around in the building there, and frankly, they looked too healthy. I didn't look like alcoholics to me, but you never know these days. As you can tell by my accent, I'm not from around here, or you might be able to tell. I'm from down south, New York City, and which is south of here. So I'm a southerner to you guys. I'm original, but I live up in Cape Cod now, and I get sober down there in New York. As I said, this has become one of my passions because what happened was I was in AA for a couple of years and not really getting it. I was sober. And at some point, aside from a lot of the other activities that that some of you guys get involved with trying to carry the message to people, someone took me aside and told me what I'm about to tell you. And he told it probably a lot better than I do, but it made a real big impression on me, and it really impacted my sobriety in a phenomenal way. I was at a retreat a couple of years ago, and probably about 4 or 5 years ago, and I met this fellow from Pennsylvania, and he didn't even have a year under his belt, and he was having a rough time, and very nice guy, and we got to talking, and he said, "I heard you talking about Bill and Bob and all that stuff in the hallway." He says, "What is all that stuff? I don't even know anything about it." He didn't even own a big book yet. And so I said, "Well, come on, I'll tell you." So we went up into his room, and we spent about 2 hours together. And I just, from memory, just told him what I knew about AA and its beginnings. And a lot of us know that it started. You know, a lot of us think. I thought it started when I got here, to be honest with you. But there was 70 years before that, or at that time, 60 some odd years before that, that really, if you know it, it can really have an impact on you. And I started telling this guy about what I knew, And he sat there and he said, that was amazing. And the time just flew like that. I mean, we were sitting there in his room for like 2 hours. We missed lunch and all this stuff. And I ran into the guy a year later, and he said, he took me aside, and I said, "You still sober?" He said, Yeah. And he said, "You know, he says, I got to tell you, one of the most important things that's happened to me so far," he says, "was that talk we had." And I said, "Really?" And he said, "Yeah." I said, "You know, that stuff's important to me, too." And he said, "No, I want to tell you." He says, "I think I had a spiritual awakening that weekend, and I think that part of it had to do with the story, the things that we talked about." And I said, "Okay, well, that's fine." And I was thinking about it, and I started to make a habit or a practice of actually, when I sponsor people, to sit down and go over this stuff. And I don't use notes. I don't, you know, occasionally I refer to the big book, but I don't use notes, and everything's out of my head. And the same experience, I heard lots of people come back and say, "Wow, that's just incredible," and the time just flies. So I know you're all drinking a lot of coffee and eating food. I hope the time flies for you, too. We're not going to finish it all. I mean, it's just so much of it. But is there anybody here, a historian of sorts in AA, knows the whole story? A lot of people know a lot of stuff. You are. Are you? She thinks she's a historian. Okay. Well, I don't even think I am. But I'll start off with... I just wanted to get my background there and a little bit. There's a couple of... She said there was whiteboards, and actually, believe it or not, this thing is being reduced to slides, but I didn't want to get involved in all the audiovisual stuff today. And there are actually handouts that we give out that's just pictures and stuff of some of the players, but I didn't bring them because I forgot. But but if anybody wants them, I'll put out a sheet and give me your email. I'll be happy to email them to you. And I'm doing this actually a little bit differently than I ever have. I don't go right now. It's not a class, but I have this, so I might as well use it. And one of the way I decided to talk about it was not so much from a, well, to start off from maybe a geographic standpoint. Here we have, because you can't believe it, a lot of people think AA started in this country. It really didn't even start in this country if you follow it back far enough. It really has roots in a lot of different places. It has roots in England. Can't see this, don't worry about it. Because even if you could see, you probably won't be able to read it anyway. Down here we have China. You didn't know that, huh? China. Where's France relative? France is down here. France. Where's Switzerland?
Below France.
Below France? I don't know how to spell Switzerland. That's a cheesy talk. And then we have, I guess that's an island, and there's the English Channel, and there's all that stuff. And there's China down here. And then we have the United States, of course. We have Cape Cod. That's my history. And then we have Rhode Island. We have New York. Oh, sorry. Sorry about that. We have. How do you spell New York? And why? Y comes after the N, not on top of the N. Is that what it is? Okay. Then we actually New York City, and we have.
New Jersey.
All right. WC, World Champions. How's that? Boston Red Sox. And then we have the Bronx. All this comes into AA, believe it or not.
Take it down.
Nah, that would be a jinx. Over here we have Ohio. And that's about, that'll about handle it. Anything I forgot, I'll just add in. Oh, yeah. We have Albany, New York. That plays into it. Oh, and I forgot. We have New Hampshire. Vermont. That comes off, right?
No.
Oh, shoot.
Yeah.
It's supposed to come off.
Water.
Oh, well. Okay, I'll get in trouble. You can blame me. That'll come off. I'll figure it out. I got some alcohol in there. Rubbing alcohol. Okay, so there's a bunch of people involved here, too. And I'll tell you,
One of the reasons I'm doing this is not so much for you, but for me. Because we have, everyone knows Bill W. Bill W. is in there. We're going to talk about him. We're going to talk about Abby Thatcher, Abby T. We're going to talk about Lois. B. Burnham. We're going to talk about Bob. There's a Bob in here? Bob Smith, right. Bob Smith, MD. We're going to talk about Roland Hazard. And we're going to talk about, now this list gets pretty long. I mean, there's no way we're going to really get into the details on this. But, you know, one of the things that comes to mind, it's like, you know, the name, by the way, I don't know if anybody knows, but the name of this thing, this is a foundation meeting. And the foundation is not so much in the foundation of the steps and traditions and that stuff, but the foundation in history. And that's why we're talking about these historical figures. And the whole idea is, who invented AA? I mean, I thought it was Bill W. that invented AA. I thought maybe Dr. Bob gave him a hand. But, you know, maybe at the end of this talk, maybe you might have a different idea. Roland Hazard, Henrietta Sieberling, you gotta spell Sieberling. We have William Silkworth, who is the doctor, MD, the little doctor who loved alcoholics.
Carl Jung.
We have William Tunks. I should say Reverend William Tunks. We have Sam Shoemaker. A lot of you have heard these names, I know. And one more I think is missing, which would be Frank. Buckman. All right. I think that's it. Anybody else I can just add? Sorry about the writing. I might usually have to write that close. But anyway, I'll mention as we go along. Then I can cross it off and I know that I covered them. So a good place to start off, really, I think, is actually in England. Because in England, actually, it even starts in Philadelphia, if you think about it. I don't know if I'll get to it. But in England, there was a group called the Oxford. There was some of you have heard of the Oxford group. And in England, Oxford University, a fellow by the name of Frank Buckman, who actually started off in Philadelphia, had a spirit, what he calls, he terms a spiritual awakening. And he opened up a church down in Philadelphia. And he started a little congregation there, and he wound up getting resentment against his congregation. Okay, and once he got such a bad resentment against his congregation. I think they were voting on something that just didn't go his way. Anybody ever had that experience? And they took a vote, and whatever it was, I guess a group conscience vote down there. It didn't go his way, so he got all pissed off and he left. As a matter of fact, he left. He went so far. He went to England, and he wound up in China. And he wound up running into another guy by the name of Sam Shoemaker. Is it Shoemaker or Shoemaker? Everybody says Shoemaker. I don't know. And that was in the early 1900s, 1918, I believe. And he ran into Shoemaker. Shoemaker was a parishioner at a church in New York City. The Calvary Presbyterian Church. And Frank Buckman wound up converting him to the Oxford group that he had developed up here, which had six tenets. And these six tenets were, does anyone know them by heart? I don't either. I'm not going to look them up. But there's six tenets from where our steps come from. Confession, restitution, there's a whole bunch of them. And he actually took that idea back to this country and opened up
started pushing that idea in New York.
Right, setting that aside, the Oxford Group began to open up chapters in Akron. So the Oxford Group comes over here, Akron, and then in New York. So they had, plus they had,
but that was the only, those weren't the only two places. They were actually all over the place. They were in South America, Switzerland, Egypt, France. They were really all over the place. And the way he did it was he went for the reason why he got the name the Oxford Group, because they really didn't call themselves that. They were the first century Christian group, is what they called themselves. And he really didn't, but they were referred to kind of in a denigrating fashion as the Oxford Group, because it was really comprised of Oxford students, Oxford University students. And, you know, when you're young and impressionable, it's easy to get them to join your little, at that time, they considered it a cult. I guess you still would consider it a cult.
Okay. Let's stop there with that. Then we go to, let's start with Roland Hazard. No, let's start with New Hampshire. Up in New Hampshire, has anyone ever heard of
Manchester? Somebody know where that is? Anybody ever been there? It's a nice place, right? It's always been a nice place, and it's always been sort of a resort community. A lot of wealthy people go up there. They have I think they have skiing up there, probably. And they have a big lake. They have equinoxes up there, and there's some hotels up there. It's always been that kind of a community, sort of like Cape Cod. They had summer people, and they had winter people, and the place would clear out in the wintertime, and then the summer people would come back in. And a lot of them came from New York, and they had summer homes up there.
Well, some of the people that vacationed there in the summertime was, I'll tell you who they were right off the bat. You had the Hazard family, you had the Thatcher family, you had the Burnham family with Lois. Who else did you have up there? That's it for this story. And Bill W., who was from, who at the time was living in East Dorset, Vermont. Anybody ever been up there to the house, to the Wilson house up there in East Dorset?
Yeah? Next weekend.
You going up next weekend? Okay, good, good. Well, he lived up there with his grandfather, and there's a whole story behind that, too. But he enrolled in the ROTC program.
Up that way.
And so he frequented the New Hampshire, he frequented Manchester a lot. Now, he was a young kid then, and I don't know what you did when you were a young kid. Well, actually, I do know what you did when you were a young kid. Well, you know what I did. I hung out with other young kids, and we drank. So all these people knew each other. In fact, even Ebby used to travel, and his family used to travel all the way from Albany to there. It's really not that far. It's not even, I don't think it's even an hour drive. Maybe it's about an hour drive. So they would all vacation up there. The first one, really, that comes into the story here, and of any real big significance, is really the Roland Hazard. I tell you, that the Hazard family was very wealthy. The Hazard family had residence in took residence in Rhode Island and also in New York, and not in Long Island, in New York. In fact, Roland's father actually founded a town out in Long Island called Newtown, out in Long Island. It was a very prominent family, and they had a lot of different businesses that they owned, not just one business. They owned a railroad, they owned chemical companies, they were coke dealers. Coal that's burnt. Okay, not that kind of coke. Here on the back of his neck stood up. All right. And they also owned anybody ever heard of Allied Signal? Allied Signal's a big company. They started that. Anybody ever hear of Arm & Hammer baking soda? Anybody ever use Arm & Hammer baking soda?
Yeah.
Okay. Has many uses. They invented that. Well, they didn't invent that, but they bought that company, and that later became that company.
Anyway, so they had a lot of money, so that's why they could afford to be up there.
Roland, however, was a horrible drunk, and he was really the scourge of the family. And his father, being very, very wealthy, sent him all over the place to try and dry him out. There's always been places, hospitals and asylums and sanitariums and places to go for this kind of thing. I mean, you know, we didn't invent rehabs in this century. There were a lot of quackery back then, too. They had all these all these cures, they call them, for alcoholism. They give you enemas and they, you know, put your head in radio boxes and plug it in, and they had all kinds of stuff. You tried that, right? I believe it. Well, if none of that stuff worked. Finally, at the end of his rope, the father picks up the phone. And you know, when you're rich and powerful, you can do things like this. You pick up the phone, you say, no, you don't pick up the phone. You yell next door and you say, Betty Lou, get me Sigmund Freud. Well, Sigmund Freud was busy. You couldn't see him. He's probably busy snorting coke, but he was able to get one of Sigmund Freud's proteges, who was Carl Jung. And Carl Jung, I mean, Jungian and Freudian psychology is still revered today by the professions. You know, they've changed it quite a bit, but they really developed what we know today for counseling, therapy, and psychiatry. He sends him over to. From Rhode Island, he sends him over to Switzerland, and that's where Carl Jung is. Carl Jung is very successful. He's an author, world renowned, and he's got his own hospital out there in Zurich. Roland goes there and spends an entire year with Carl Jung under therapy. Now, can you imagine? You know, some of you have been in, some of you, I'm sure, have had counseling and whatnot in various centers, and you know, you go in there for, you know, a few days, or some of you might have been on the 28-day plans of the past, and you know, you get all unlocked, and they figure out why you drank. Well, that's what he did. He went there, and he figured out why he drank. I mean, that's the best. Carl Jung, can you imagine? Spend an entire year with Carl Jung. Very expensive proposition. I don't know the exact amount, but I seem to remember somewhere it was like $10,000. Now, at that time, $10,000 for a year to spend a year in rehab for $10,000, they get that what, a week now? It's like 10 grand a week now. It's about like $30,000, $40,000 for a month. Right? And you have to pay for it yourself now. Well, he paid for it. He gets all fixed up. He hasn't had a drink in a year. He knows everything. He knows why he faces a certain way on his toilet. He knows how long his mother breastfed him. He knows everything about his psyche. And he also knows another thing. He is definitely not going to drink again because he has absolutely no desire to drink. He gets on, at that time, you know, there wasn't planes around, so he had to get from Zurich. I think Zurich's down. I think France is down here. He has to get from Switzerland to France. He's got to get there by rail, and then he's got to take a steamship across the country. It's a long trip. Well, I guess this trip was pretty long, too, because by the time he got to France, he also picked up a drink. I mean, he didn't even make it back to the United States. He had to spend an entire year with one of the most prominent therapists of his time. And he didn't know what happened. He went back home, and the family was devastated. I mean, they were absolutely devastated. They thought for sure they had done the right thing for this guy this time. And he arrived drunk. A year later, he goes back to Jung, and he wanted his money back. No, he didn't want his money back. He didn't need it. But he figured he would help him out again. And he said, what happened? And Carl Jung looked at him. He said, we run into people like you, and I have to tell you, you are the type of alcoholic for whom there is no hope. There's just nothing for you. You're going to die an alcoholic death. And this was not good news for young Roland. And he said, well, is there any exception to this at all? Any exception? And Carl Jung was a very unusual man, even for that time, in that he had a certain, if you read some of his stuff, I've read very little myself, but from what I have read, you could tell the guy had a spirituality about him. He really did. He believed in a God. And he wrote about it. He told Roland, he said, well, once in a while, hardly ever, occasionally, we do see somebody as hopeless as you actually make it out. But not very often. He says, well, how does that happen? He says, what happens to these people is they have some kind of a transformation. They have a spiritual transformation. They usually get hooked up in a religion or something, and then they have some sort of a spiritual experience that just locks him out of it and never drink again. So Roland goes, great, he's going to start going to church. That's my answer. I'll start going to church. And Jung says, no, no. He goes, that's fantastic that you're a church goer. That's very admirable. But I'm not talking about going to church. I'm talking about a change of, a real change, a deep down spiritual change. My suggestion to you, Roland, is go find yourself a real hardcore bunch of religious people and see if you can get that transformation from them. This was not terribly good news, but at least there was a little bit of hope for Roland. He goes back to the United States and he tells Daddy, and Daddy says, if that's what he says to do, that's what we're going to do. So Daddy picks up the phone and buys him a religion. Not exactly in those terms, but what happened was he assembled a group of the Oxfords at their summer home up there. See, he set up a commune, is what he did. He set up a commune up in New Hampshire. And he set it up there, and he sent him up there. He goes, you stay with those people and see what happens. Well, he goes up there, and he's up there for months, and he's not drinking. So far, it's working. Whatever they had, those six tenets that they were following, so far, it's working. All right. So we talked about role. Now we're going to start talking about... a good one. Let's start talking about Eddie. Ebby's fun. Ebby is in Albany. His the Thatchers were also a very prominent family. His relatives were mayors of the town, and they have a statue there erected in the Thatcher family name now, and all this stuff. They were also very wealthy. They owned an accounting business, and they were connected in the business community there. Ebby is also drinking up a storm in Albany. In fact, it's quite embarrassing to the Thatcher family, big prominent family. I say, Ebby, you got to do one thing. What? Get out of here. Go. Goodbye. Leave New York. We can't have you here anymore. You're embarrassing your family. So, where's he going to go? Of course, he goes from Albany, gets in the car, and he drives up to Manchester. To the summer residence. He does a geographic, as we say, right? He's going to change his life now. He's not going to drink. He's going to dry out. He's going to get his life in order. So he goes there, and he's driving around town one day, and I'm picturing one of these, you know, Model A's, you know, and he's driving around because not everybody had a car back. If you had a car back then, you're pretty well off, you know. And he's driving around, and he makes a wrong turn somewhere, and he puts the car right through the front of someone's house and lands in their living room. And he wasn't hurt. And the woman is standing there watching this car come plowing through her house. And Ebby steps out of the car and he says, he shouted, by the way, in case you haven't figured out. And he says, madam, may I trouble you for a cup of coffee? Well, she didn't think that was very funny. And she did call the cops. And he got arrested. He got arrested for drunk driving, and he was taken into jail, and he had to go see the judge the next day. The judge's name was Judge Graves, and he went before the judge, and the judge says, "This doesn't look good. How long are you here, Ebby?" And Ebby says, "I don't know." He says, "Well, if you're not going to leave like you usually do, if you get into any more trouble, I'm sending you away. I'm sending you away." And he meant that he was going to put Ebby away. He was going to lock him up in an insane asylum. Because at that time, that's really the only thing that was available for alcoholics. I mean, you either got sober or they locked you up. I mean, that's the way it was. Because you were insane. For your own protection. Ebby promises to be a good boy. He's not going to get into any more trouble anymore. An alcoholic, you hear what I'm saying? An alcoholic is not going to get into any more trouble. I promise. Okay. He goes back home. Now, the house that they lived in Manchester was on the main street. It was on the was right in the center of town. And Ebby figures, well, I'm not going to drink. I'm going to stay out of trouble. And if I do drink, I'm going to stay out of trouble too. Right. So Ebby figures that he's going to keep himself busy. He was a pretty handy guy. So he got himself a big bucket of paint. He decides he's going to start working on the house. It's going to become a home builder now, or a home improvement expert. So he gets himself a bucket of paint and some booze. Because after all, if he's busy doing painting the house, he can't get in trouble if it's shit fest, right? So he starts painting the house. Unfortunately, he had a little bit too much, and he could only make it up the first two rungs of the ladder. Otherwise, he'd fall off. And he didn't want to get too high up. So he's painting like this, and he paints this big yellow stripe along the bottom of the house. And that's about as far as he got. He got to the end, and just as he's finishing, he looks up and he notices there's a bunch of pigeons have landed up on the house. And what are pigeons famous for? Well, they're famous for a few more things, because I have pigeons, by the way. I raise pigeons. And I spend every weekend shoveling pigeon shit, okay? Pounds and pounds of pigeon shit. If anybody wants some. Don't let you... Anybody grow tomatoes here? Nobody grows tomatoes, okay. Well, I sold some on eBay over in Taiwan. It's a very coveted prize, my pigeon shit. I have a lot of shit. Okay. I shouldn't say shit so much, should I? He decides that he doesn't want these pigeons up there because the pigeons have begun, here it comes, to shit on his paint. And the pigeon shit is running into his yellow paint. Well, Ebby is infuriated. He goes running into the house, and he comes running back out. He's got a 12-gauge shotgun. And he starts blasting up in the pigeons are flying, and he's shooting the thing up in the air, trying to kill the pigeons. And this is in the center of town. You know, now this is the 1800s, not the 1900s, not the 1800s. It's not exactly the Wild Wild West, but, you know, ordinances have gone into place in most civilized societies and towns. And you're really not allowed to run down the main street shooting a shotgun off of the air. The neighbors just didn't like it. So they called the police, and Ebby gets arrested again. Now he's in real trouble, because he's going away now. He's got to go before Judge Graves again. Meanwhile, in the Oxford commune, Roland hears about this. He hears about the problem. And he decides he's going to show up for the hearing. So Roland has it, who's now not drinking, a person by the name of Sebra Graves, who happened to be the son of the judge who went down there, happened to be in the Oxford group. Coincidence, right? And another fellow by the name of Shep Cornell go down, and it was all set up. I mean, I think it was set up. I don't know. But they all the judge's son is showing up, and they manage to get Ebby released in their recognizance to the Oxford group on one condition: get him the hell out of the state. Just get him out of here. We don't want him here. And they said, we would get him out of there. So Ebby now is up here in the commune in the with the Oxford people. That wasn't right, well. And with the Oxford people, and they send him down to New York, to New York City, Lower Manhattan. And guess where they send him to? Remember our friend Sam? Well, Sam has now become the pastor of the church in New York City at the First Calvary Church, and has actually set up a mission away from the church, where derelicts and alcoholics and people who need help, it was like a soup kitchen type of thing, and he's getting to push the Oxford group stuff that he learned in China when he had his conversion, when Frank Buckman was there. So Ebby is now down there handing out soup and whatever he does down there, and he's helping other people, and he's not drinking, he's following the tenets, the six tenets. One of them, of course, is to help others. That's the sixth tenet, which later became part of our 12th step, right? Okay, now let's talk about... I'm just setting this all up and we're bringing it together. Let's talk about Bill. Bill W. Bill W. and Lois. Bill W. and Lois, of course, you know, they fall in love up there. And they wind up getting married. Bill has to go. Bill, he's in the ROTC program up there. And he goes as a second lieutenant to France. Before he goes, though, he's down right around here, actually. Fairhaven?
His
first drink in Fairhaven. He has his first drink. He was stationed, actually, in Fairhaven. It's actually Fairhaven?
No.
Okay. Well, most people never, but they've heard of New Bedford or...
Fairhaven,
it's on the line.
This area.
The bottle's on the line.
Okay. Well, he's in the neighborhood. This neighborhood. And he has, see, this is where I identify with you people, because Fairhaven is over here somewhere, and here's the Bronx, and he has a Bronx cocktail. Anybody ever heard of a Bronx cocktail? He has a Bronx cocktail. It's made of, I never heard of a Bronx, I'm from the Bronx, I never heard of a Bronx cocktail. Bronx cocktail, just, you know, whatever we could find. Because it was vermouth, gin, I think it was vermouth, gin, and orange juice. And he has that, and he had the same experience that we all know about. He felt like he belonged. You know, he talks about it extensively in his writings later on, how he felt. He felt powerful. He felt the uncomfortability started to leave. And he knew that alcohol was a solution to Bill's problem that he had never even knew he really had until it was gone. Anyway, he takes that experience and he goes over to Europe, he goes to France, he goes to England, he comes across, you know, he goes to Winchester Cathedral, he has a spiritual experience at Winchester Cathedral, at the gravestone. Many of you know about the gravestone. And he's over there, he's in love with Lois, they're married, and he's still at war. Okay. He comes back, and they move in with Lois's parents. Lois with the Burnham family. The Burnham family, you know, was one of the wealthy people up there. They were he was a dentist, actually, in Brooklyn Heights in New York City, which now is it's quite a la-di-da neighborhood right now. Been totally regentrified. And they move in with Brooklyn here. So they moved to 182 Clinton Street in Brooklyn, and that's where they're living. And Bill is drinking like nothing. He gets a job at an insurance company. And he tries to get a law degree. He was too drunk to take the test. I don't know if he showed up or not. I know he's too drunk to take the test. Even if he had taken it, I guess he probably wouldn't have passed. And things are not looking too good. He's really gets ridden out on a rail out of Wall Street. And I can tell you, my background also happens to be from Wall Street. I was an investment banker. And I can tell you, when you get a bad reputation on Wall Street, nobody wants to touch you. Nobody wants to touch you anymore. So he's out of work, out of money. His wife, Lois, finally goes to get a job. And she gets a job working at Macy's on 34th Street in Manhattan. And she's bringing home that, you know, a little bit of money, whatever little money she can get from that. And Bill's stealing the money out of her purse and buying booze and making booze, making bathtub gin. Because at that time, bathtub gin, well, I don't know the exact recipe, but it doesn't sound too good. I know it's got juniper berries in it. And I don't even know why they would call it gin. There's no gin in it, but it got your shit fixed, I guess. And people would make this stuff in the bathtub, and they'd put it in big jars, mayonnaise jars or whatever, and they'd hide it all around the house. Well, that's what Bill was doing. Ebby is working at the Mission. Bill is shattered in Brooklyn. And Ebby hears about Bill's condition. And he knows that he's got to help another alcoholic, or he's got to help another person, because that's part of the Oxford Group deal. So he's going to go now and keep his salvation. But don't forget, it's not only just about drinking at that time with the Oxford Group. It was about going to heaven. You know, they had a God, and you accepted their God, just like most religions. And Ebby had picked it up. He gives Bill a call one day, and Bill has been in and out of Towns Hospital. I'm going to get to that in Towns Hospital in a moment. But Bill has been in and out of rehab, we'll call it, for lack of a better word. And he's not doing so well. He's met up with Dr. Silkworth. He's been introduced to Dr. Silkworth. But it's not working. Whatever treatment. He's just drying out his detox and he's going back out. Ebby comes back. Ebby comes to Brooklyn, calls him up and says, I want to talk to you. Now, Bill is absolutely ecstatic over this. He hasn't seen Ebby in a while. He doesn't know that Ebby is sober. And he can't wait to see him. But I don't know about you, I used to love to hang out with people who drank worse than I did. And that's what, because if you couldn't keep up with me, you weren't worth shit, to be honest with you, because you'd probably be going home early or doing something stupid like wanting to call your wife or something, and you'd be a big pain in the ass. Ebby and Bill had a great time drinking together. As a matter of fact, One time they were in, they actually were up in Manchester, or they weren't in Manchester, they were away from Manchester, they wanted to get to Manchester, and they actually, the Manchester airport was about to open, and they wanted to get there for the grand opening of the airport, because there were no airports up there at that time, and air travel was just coming into vogue at the time. And Ebby and Bill get shit-faced, and they decide, let's get an airplane and fly to Manchester. Which they did. They got a pilot. I don't know if the pilot was drinking, but I tell you, Abby and Bill were. And they get there for the grand opening of the Manchester airport, and they pull in and they step out of the plane, and the band's playing and the banners are flying, and everyone is cheering, and cheerleaders are jumping up and down, and they're stepping off the plane and, you know, soaking in the glory. Unfortunately, they got there the day before the opening. That was the high school practicing for the next day. But it's stories like that. He wanted to get together with Ebby and talk about the good old days, you know. So Ebby gets on a train, goes out to 182 Clinton Street. Bill opens the door. He walks in. Most of you know this story. He walks in, and Bill takes one look at him and says, well, something's wrong with this guy, you know. He was clear-eyed, he was sober, he had color in his face, and he sat Ebby down, and he poured him up a big tumbler of his bathtub gin, one for himself, which, by the way, mixed with pineapple juice. He wasn't drinking it straight. This was a social event. This wasn't real serious drinking, you know. And he figured that if Lois came home and caught him drinking, at least if he mixed with pineapple juice, it wouldn't be anything serious, you know. Mostly he drank it straight. And he looks at Ebby and he says, what's up with you? What's going on? How come you're not drinking? And Ebby says one thing that was Bill did not want to hear. He says, I found religion. And Bill says, holy shit. Okay. You know, that's the end of this. That's the end of this happy event. But he was curious about it. What he didn't know was that Ebby was there with a purpose. Ebby was there to, what we know today as the 12-step end, to do a 12-step call. They didn't know it at the time, but that's exactly what he was there for. He was there to bring him the six tenets of the Oxford Group and to save his soul. And Bill just wasn't having any of it. And he started running his Oxford Group routine on Bill, and Bill just was rejecting the God issue. Bill was basically, he wasn't an atheist, but he was an agnostic. And he believed in that there was something controlling the universe, but like he says, a czar of the heavens, I just can't buy that. I just can't buy that at all. And this is frustrating Ebby terribly, because Ebby has got to run his routine on him. He can't save his soul if he's not taking the God thing. He's not buying the God thing. Ebby finally says, all right. I'm imagining Ebby thinking that. He's not taking the God thing. He's not taking the Oxford Group God thing. Well, shit, I'm stuck. All right. Bill, use whatever God you want. Use your own conception of God. Don't use ours. And Bill says at that moment that he was flawed. He was flawed. He'd never considered that before. And he figured, geez, maybe that's something. I can't take this God, this Ebby's God, this Oxford Group God, but if I could come up with my own conception of God, a God of my own understanding, maybe that would be a foundation at least, and I could build what I see in my friend, and I could start from there. It would be a beginning. At least it would be a beginning. And he wanted it. He wanted to believe Ebby's God, but he couldn't. But at least it was a beginning. Okay. Bill continues to drink, by the way. That wasn't his, he didn't stop drinking after that. What time is it? Do I still get time for the break?
It's after.
Oh, we better break, right?
Or yeah,
let's break it quarter after. Okay. Could you remind me, somebody? Okay.
Sure.
All right. In the meantime, we'll get Dr. Bob out of the way here. Dr. Bob is all the way over here in Ohio, and Dr. Bob is a good doctor. He's a drinking doctor. In fact, he's drunk away his entire practice just about. And his house. He's married to a woman named Ann. That's what I should have put here. Ann Smith. Ann Smith is a very spiritual woman. She's very spiritual because she needs help, because her husband is a drunk. And as a doctor, he's already got a bad reputation. He's a proctologist, as a matter of fact. And the last thing you want, if you don't see a proctologist, is a shaky proctologist. Especially one who reportedly had very large hands. So his practice is going down the drain, and so is his house and his finances. And seek spiritual help, spiritual guidance. Where does she go? The Oxford Group in Akron, Ohio. There she meets Henrietta Sieberling. Henrietta is the wife of an alcoholic. That's why she's at the Oxford Group, looking for spirituality on her own. And she identified with Anne, and they became very good friends. She was actually married into the family. This family actually founded Firestone Rubber out in Akron, Ohio, and was extremely wealthy, as you can imagine. They go into meetings, and it was a practice of, they had meetings, they would meet every week and sit down in a room in a church basement, raise their hands, share. Gee, never heard of that. But they would do all that sort of stuff. And one of the things that they got in, one of their practices was once a month, because they had this practice about prayer. You weren't allowed in the Oxford Group to pray for yourself. It was seen as something that was selfish and self-centered. You know, foxhole prayers, we all know them. And what they did was, it was okay to pray as long as you prayed for somebody else. As long as you were praying for somebody else. And that's a principle that we have in our steps today. In the third step and seventh step. And in step 11, it's okay to pray for somebody else. And we can pray for ourselves as long as we're being helpful to somebody else in the process. And that kind of came from that idea. So what they would do is, if you had a problem, once a month you would stand up and you would tell the entire group your problem. And then for the next month, the people in that group would go home and they'd get up in the morning and they'd get on their knees and they would pray for you, because they believed in the power of prayer. But you weren't allowed to pray for yourself. And Dr. Bob was Dr. Bob's turn one day. And Dr. Bob gets up and he says, I don't know how to say this, and I know you're going to be shocked, but I got a problem with drinking. And they all they were ready to cheer, you know. No shit, Bob. You know? And he was shocked that they knew. I mean, he had no idea. He thought he'd been hiding it so well. And they went about praying for Bob for the next month. And I think we'll stop right there before the break. Okay. And we'll take a quick break. 5 minutes?
5 minutes.
Okay. I can finish my sandwich. All right, welcome back, everybody. We left off with Bob.
Yeah.
We left off with Bob. Dr. Bob. Okay. Dr. Bob, oh yeah, okay, now I know where you are. All right, let's go back, let's just go back to New York for a moment, because we're going to leave New York again and go back to Ohio. So we'll go back to Dr. William Silkworth. We're not going to finish everything today, my God. But Dr. Silkworth is a little guy. Silky, they started to call him later. Bill actually started calling him that. And Dr. Silkworth was he was just a general practitioner in New York, and he lost all his money in the stock market crash in 1928. And just don't forget, we're starting the Depression days for a lot of this history. And he was broke. And Charlie Towns owned a hospital in Central Park West, where he had a little, a treatment room or whatever for alcoholics. And he ran alcoholics in there. New York's got a few alcoholics. Even today, New York has a few alcoholics running around in Lower Manhattan, in Midtown Manhattan. But that's what Charlie Towns was doing, and he offered Silkworth a job. Now, Silkworth did not really consider himself to be a specialist in alcoholism. As a matter of fact, he didn't really know very much about it, as most doctors don't today either. But he took the job because he needed the money. I think it only paid like $40 a week or something like that. It was a small amount of money, but he needed the money. He was broke. So he went there. I don't think that's why he went to college, was to work with derelicts, you know, who comes staggering into a treatment center or a hospital. But that's what he wound up doing. And that's where he met Bill W. Bill is still in his cups, and he goes, he tries to sober himself up. He basically would check himself into Towns Hospital. And one of his visits to Dr. Silkworth, Dr. Silkworth presents to him a theory that we hold today, actually, in AA, and it's becoming less and less of a theory. And if you identify with it, it's not a theory at all. I know for me it's not a theory, it's a reality. But Dr. Silkworth comes up with this theory, what we often refer to today as the allergic theory, that an alcoholic of Bill's type has a physical allergy to alcohol. And that means he has an abnormal reaction that most other people don't have. A lot of people have a problem with the allergy theory because when they think of an allergy, they think of, you know, histamines and antihistamines and attacking harmless proteins in your body and rashes and coughing and sneezing and that kind of stuff. That's an allergy too. But even if you pick up a Merriam-Webster's dictionary, you'll find that. But you'll also, that's definition number one. But definition number two refers more to an abnormal reaction to a substance or a food, or even situations, believe it or not, that most of the other population does not experience. And he said that allergy, that abnormal reaction, was in the form, he called it the phenomenon of craving. I'll actually read to you exactly the way he puts it. We, from the doctor's opinion, we believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all, and once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. And I could tell you that the way I look at that for myself, I mean, I've had, if I take that bit of information, I look back in my history, I've got that allergy. I do not react. I never reacted to alcohol the way other people did. And, when we all stand up at the podiums like this and tell our stories, it's that information that the alcoholic, part of the information that the alcoholic will identify with, and I certainly do. I would not put, I mean, I am convinced, and I'm not going to try it, don't worry, but I am convinced that if I took an eyedropper full of vanilla extract and put a drop under each eyelid, I'm drinking. I'm going to get a craving. Any alcohol enters my body, that's what will happen to me. And that does not happen to most people, and I'm not trying it, don't worry. I don't need to try that. So he tells him that theory. Now, Bill is ecstatic. Bill loves it. Bill thought, you know, like all of us, thought that he drank because he was a rotten, no-good, dirty, scoundrel creep. And that's what I thought. I thought I must be a bad person. I never put the idea that maybe there was something physically wrong with me. I didn't know. And Bill didn't know. And this answered the question. Bill now had the solution in his mind to his drinking problem. All I have to do is not pick up the first drink. And if I don't pick up the first drink, I can't get drunk. And that was the solution. So Bill now is going to go out in the world and he's just not going to drink. Because if he drinks, then the craving will set in and then he'll have the problem. So Bill is now out and about and he's not drinking and he's doing all right with this theory. And Lois is ecstatic. I mean, this was really hope. I mean, you know, if any of you were married at the time that you were trying to stop drinking, were in a relationship, or even if you were living with your parents at the time, every time you went into a rehab or came back out and came, I got it now, I got it this time, and everybody's hope would go up, and even yours, and then the next thing you know, you just coming out of a blackout and you don't know how it happened, you know? Well, Bill hadn't reached that point yet, and he's feeling good about himself. He's feeling healthy, and he decides he's going to go out to Staten Island to play golf. And he goes out to, he takes a bus, and he's on a bus. Now, in New York City, well, what happened with the bus is, the bus got into a little fender bender on the way to the country club. And what happens in New York City, even back then, is when, you, when you're on a, I don't know what they do around here, but if a New York City bus, any vehicle in the transit system has, if it just like scrapes the side of a mailbox and gets a little scratch or something, boom, it's out, the bus goes out of service, they dispatch a new bus, all the passengers gotta get off. The bus drivers love it, you know, because they just, you know, they just wait an hour for another bus, they don't have to drive. And that's what happened to Bill. While he was doing this, while he's waiting, he befriends this one of the passengers, and he tells him, Bill tells him his whole story, his whole horror story about drinking and then where it brought him and everything that he lost and how rich he was and suddenly he's poor, his wife and everything else. And the guy's listening, and he's amazed. He's amazed, and he's happy for the guy. He's happy for Bill W. because Bill W. obviously has found the answer. He's just not going to drink. If I don't take any alcohol in my body, I can't have that allergic reaction. So he's not going to drink. So they go out to the golf course, and before they actually go into the into play golf, there's a country club there, and a restaurant. And the guy says, well, "Before we go, why don't we stop off and have a sandwich in this in the clubhouse here?" So they go to the clubhouse, and Bill says, "That's a great idea to sit down." And now it's Armistice Day, which Armistice Day is today Veterans Day, and back then it was a big, and rightfully so, it was a much bigger celebration than we kind of use today, because we had the wars, we had the World War I, World War II, and we were much more into, you know, Vietnam hadn't happened yet, so that was a big, that was a day to celebrate. And the bartender decides he's going to buy a round for the entire bar. And you know what happens when a bartender buys a round, or anybody buys a round. I mean, that's, I love that. You know, all of a sudden you hear those shot glasses hitting the wood, poom, 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 you know, and they get around to Bill, and poom, 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 and then the bottle comes spinning around, and you're waiting for it to come, and it gets there, and boop, boop, it gets there, and Bill looks at the glass, and takes it, and chugs it back down his throat, and puts down the glass, empty. And the guy looks at him, and he goes, he just can't believe what he just saw. He says, wait a minute, if the word you just told me, you mean to tell me that you're just going to pick up that glass and just, like nothing, just drink it like that? Are you insane? And Bill just looked at him and he said, yes, I am. And Bill went on a bender. And obviously the craving kicked in. The abnormal reaction kicked in, the allergy. And he went on another bender. As a matter of fact, later on that day, Bill came home. And after all the hope and everything that Bill had, that Lois had. Lois came home from Macy's that day and came up the subway, walked over to the house, and it was Bill on the fence, leaning on the fence, swinging on the gate. Just swinging on the gate. And when he saw her, he got up and he looked at her, and Bill says that that was the moment that he saw all hope just drain from her. Her eyes just went stale. And many of you, I see heads shaking. I see heads shaking. My head's shaking too. That's happened to me also. And fortunately, I'm alive to tell about, to talk of it. Bill has now lost all hope. Lois has lost all hope, and they just don't know what to do. Bill goes back to Towns Hospital for a final time, and guess who follows him there? Remember Ebby? Ebby is still down here. Ebby, in early December, notice the 12-step work Ebby's doing here. Okay? You know, Ebby met Bill. Bill tells him, I'm not buying the guy's stuff. And Ebby didn't say, well, you're not ready to. Call me when you're ready. He didn't say that. He was on his ass. He followed him to the hospital. He followed him to the hospital. He went to the hospital on December 11th and December 12th of that year during a blinding snowstorm in New York, which wasn't that easy to do back then. It's never easy. He followed him in, and he started actually taking Bill through we call it the steps today. It was the Oxford steps, the six tenets, which later on became the steps. And Bill never drank again. But what happened was, Bill, you'll often hear that Bill never took the steps. I don't buy it. You talk about Bill taking the steps. If you go to start at page 12 in Bill's story and go on to page 18, you'll see where Bill did take these steps. And I know he didn't take it out of Bill didn't take the steps out of the big book. Well, of course Bill didn't take the steps out of the big book. He hadn't written the big book yet. It's like me telling my Aunt Grace that she doesn't have a good recipe for an apple pie because she never wrote it down. But damn, she makes a good apple pie. He takes those steps, and you can actually, I have them marked off where they are, and we don't have time to go over it, but if you want to check out page 12 and on, he does it. He goes through steps 3, because he's already taken step 2, right? He's willing from his talk with Abby. And step 3, he makes a decision, and then he goes, takes it all the way up to steps 8, where he makes a list for his restitution. Bill is in his bed one night, and he has the famous hot flash that he talks about. He's in his room, and his room lights up. There's a flash, his white light experience, we call it. And he talks about a breeze, or wind and spirit that filled the room. And that's where he has his spiritual conversion. The one that Carl Jung talked about, told Roland he had to have. And the one that Dr. Silkworth talked about at the same time, which I didn't touch on much, right? But we're running out of time. He has that experience and he never drinks again. So Bill sets out to rule the world now. He sets out to rule the world. He starts making his rounds. And what he did, well, put it this way. I've done a lot of drinking in Manhattan. If I was sitting there at a bar, and everybody knows what Bill W. looks like. If I saw some skinny, lanky guy like Bill W. in a dirty suit, come walking into a bar and start telling me how God was in his room the other night and I got to stop drinking, I don't think I would. I'd light up his room all right. I'd light up his whole nose. But so he wasn't having much luck doing that. And he really wasn't getting people sober. Bill starts to get a little bit of credibility back with his Wall Street buddies, and they start to give him some work to do. And he goes out to, they send him out to, actually out to Akron. There was a proxy battle going on with a rubber machine company. And if you don't know what a proxy battle is, all that means is, one of the other reasons I identify with Bill so much is because I was also a stockbroker on Wall Street for many years, and I identify with very much of his lifestyle and what happened to him. A proxy battle is nothing more than just a takeover at that time. If somebody was trying to take over companies, usually the shareholders. There's a lot of preparation that's involved. You don't just show up and buy a company. It could take years to even set it up and to get the minority shareholders to vote to take over the company from the existing management, usually, or the existing majority shareholders. It's basically people are going to lose their company. And they usually fight it, unless they're looking to make the money on the sale of their stock. And Bill had to go out there with a little team from the investment banking firm that he worked for at the time, or that contracted him, and he went out there to make this deal fly out to Akron, Ohio. He's in the... He gets out to Akron, and he's working on the deal. And I don't know the mechanics of this particular deal, but it didn't get off. The deal did not get off. After all that preparation and everything, and everyone's heart sank, and they did not wind up taking over this rubber machine company. And I could tell you from times myself when I needed that money, when I really needed that money, I needed that commission. I'll tell you, to have something like that happen, it really... It's a good excuse to drink, I tell you that, you know. Bill is in the hotel. He's staying at the Mayflower Hotel, and he's not feeling so hot about himself. He's in shall we call it, self-pity. He's in the pity pot, as we say. I mean, he was so far in the pity pot, he was just, you know, peering out over the lid. And the rest of his investment banking team had already gone back to New York, and it's Friday night or Friday afternoon. And Bill's ego steps in, and he says, first of all, he didn't have enough money to check out. You ever been in a hotel, you weren't sure if you had the money to check out or not? Geez, I can't stay here, but I can't leave. Well, he also decided that he also decided, I'm staying all weekend, and on Monday morning, I'm going to make this deal fly, and I'm going to save the day. Bill's going to save the day, okay? And he's pacing this nervously in the hotel lobby, and if any of you have done any traveling, I love hotel lobbies, because it means something. It's very symbolic to me, because I'm usually away from home. My wife is nowhere nearby. She has no idea how late I'm staying out, what condition I'm in, nothing. You know, how much I'm drinking, she just has no idea. And next door to the hotel lobby, there's always another room. And in that room, it's usually a bar. In this case, it was a gay bar. Right? Doesn't say it's a gay bar in the book? There was a gay crowd in the bar. No? As I said, I get a lot of these facts wrong, but it's the spirit that I tell it. That's more what it is. So Bill is now hearing these gay people calling to him in the bar next door. And he's tempted to go inside. As a matter of fact, Bill has decided that he's going to drink. And if you don't get anything out of this talk today, please get this part at least. Because it's something that we kind of skimp over a lot in this fellowship. Bill is hitting a trigger. Okay? A trigger. His trigger is suddenly decided that things have gone wrong, and he needs, what does he need? He needs companionship. He needs companionship. Okay? But companionship, because he's going to be lonely over this weekend waiting. He doesn't want to be lonely. Okay? So he's convinced himself that if he could find a companion, and you can take that to mean whatever you want, but I think I read between the lines on that one a little bit, maybe. He wants a companion. And then he decides that he can't drink, but he can have some ginger ale. He can have some ginger ale. And he can sit there at a table and get a companion and drink some ginger ale. Now, how realistic is this getting? And from there he goes, and this happens in a matter of seconds. He says, all right, no ginger ale. Shoot, three drinks, no more. So he goes, gay companion ginger ale, drink, in like 2 seconds. Gay crowd, you know, the crowd, not a gay companion, gay crowd companion ginger ale, three drinks, no more. And he says he was on thin ice. But something happened right there. Now everybody, a lot of people think that Bill went to a phone booth after that and got involved in calling up people looking for an alcoholic to help, and then forgot about his drinking problem and forgot about his desire to drink. And that's not really what happened. If you read very carefully, you might see it a little bit differently. What happened was his thoughts turned. He had the desire to drink. His thoughts turned. He said, what about the other alcoholics I'm supposed to help? What about them? He hadn't done anything yet. He hadn't even thought of the phone booth yet. What about the other alcoholics that I'm supposed to help? That Abby said, the Oxford group said I had to help other people. What about those people? The moment Bill stopped thinking about himself, the desire to drink left at that moment. He thanked God and then turned and walked towards that phone booth. And he came up to the phone directory and he started going up and down the names, and he came up to the name Reverend Walter Tunks. And there's a lot of, who knows why he picked that name. I have a picture of the directory. There's a lot of names on that directory. Why he picked that, I don't know. There's all kinds of theories. I know that Punk is a card game. It was a popular card game back then. And it was a form of gin rummy. I don't know. There are other theories, but that's one I'm picking. And he picked this Walter Punk name and called him up. And he said, he told him what his situation was. And he said, I need some people, some alcoholics to talk to you. Do you have anybody that I can help? And he said, I really can't help you. He put him in touch with another gentleman who he called and said, I can't help you either. He says, but I'll give you a list of names. And he gave him a list of names. He gave him 10 names to call. Bill was the first telemarketer. You didn't know that. Bill takes his list, and he starts going down the list, and he's not getting through to anybody. They're not there. I don't know if they had busy signals back then. I don't know if it was, it wasn't one of those number of employees. I don't know. It wasn't one of those deals. But he's going through, and he gets to the last name. He recognizes it as Sieberling. And he recognizes that name because that's the owner of the rubber company there, of Firestone Rubber. So he figures that's probably a good one. And he calls, and Henrietta picks up the phone, and Bill says, first words out of his mouth, he says, my name is Bill, I'm a rum hound from New York, and I have a fix for alcoholics. Now you have to remember, Henrietta's been on her knees looking for a solution for Dr. Bob. So she's not surprised. She's, oh yeah, okay. Finally, well, it's about time. What are the chances? Do you see any coincidences happening in this story at all? She gets a hold of Ann, calls up Ann and says, the guy's here. He's finally here. Oh, it's about time. Says, well, we got to hook him up with Bill. Bring him over. And Ann says, well, we can't do that tonight. And she says, why not? The sooner the better. She says, well, it was the day before Mother's Day. And Bob had gone out to buy a potted plant for her for Mother's Day. And unfortunately, he was planted himself potted underneath the kitchen table. It wasn't going anywhere. So they set it up for the next day. And a lot of you have seen the movie. A lot of you have seen this movie. They get there, and Dr. Bob's on his way there, and he says, I'm going to give this guy 15 minutes of my time, and that's it, and I'm out of here. Okay? Why? Because his time is so precious. He's got so many patients, butts to work on. He's got to get back to drinking. He couldn't very well show up shit-faced to this meeting. He knows that's about all he can take. So he gets out there, and he's going to give him his 15 minutes. They arrived at Henrietta's house, which was actually the gatehouse to the mansion of the rubber magnate's family. And they go into the study, and that was at 5 o'clock in the evening. And they emerged at 11:15 that night. For the sake of time, I'll just read to you what Bob says about that day, what happened to him in that room when he was talking to Bill. It was June 10th, 1935. And he's talking to us now, and he says, the question which might naturally come into your mind would be, what did the man, Bill, do or say that was different from what others had done or said? Because don't forget, everybody's been telling Bob his whole life how to straighten out. Did anybody ever tell you how to stop drinking before you stopped? Everybody was telling you what to do. You got to do this, you got to do that. Try beer. What did the man do or say that was different from what others had said, done or said? It must be remembered that I had read a great deal and talked to everyone I knew or thought they knew anything about the subject of alcoholism. But this was a man who had experienced many years of frightful drinking, who had had most all of the drunkard's experience known to man, but who had been cured by the very means I had been trying to employ, that is to say, the spiritual approach in the answer group. He gave me information about the subject of alcoholism, which was undoubtedly helpful. Of far more importance was the fact that he was the first living human with whom I had ever talked who knew what he was talking about in regard to alcoholism from actual experience. In other words, he talked my language. He knew all the answers, and certainly not because he had picked them up in his reading. Bill was Bob's answer man. And, you know, we like to say in this program, I don't have all the answers. No, we don't have all the answers. But we damn well better have the answer to alcoholism. Because that's what's helped us, and that's what we have to pass on to other people. We have a chapter in this book called There is a Solution. And it would be pretty sadistic for them to put that chapter in there and then not put the solution in it, right? He was his answer man. And the rest became the rest of that is history. Tying up a few loose ends, there's a lot more to this story. There's so much more. There's so much I didn't even talk about. And there's so much I need to be corrected about, too. But I told you, there are better historians in here than I am. But Bill and Bob went out to help other alcoholics. Bob did not sober up right away. He continued to drink. I'll just make the one final point before we close about Bob and how he finally did get sober. They did go out to help other alcoholics. They met alcoholic number 3, Bill Dodson, an attorney, in a hospital bed. They ran the same thing by him. They told their experience. They didn't tell him what to do or how to stay sober. They told him how they stayed sober, which is why this book starts off in the foreword. In the early foreword. Does anybody read this book once in a while? The foreword to the first edition. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. And they're conveying their experience. They're not saying, you do this and you do that. But if you do, do it. And they do it as a suggestion. Just like is suggested you pull down your pants if you're going to make a poop. It's a suggestion. And Bob did not want to... Bob did not want to be told what to do, and Bill didn't tell him what to do. He just told him what he did, and that's what they did. They went out to help other alcoholics. Bob was... I guess you could call Bob a chronic relapser. He just kept drinking. One day, there's a story about his trip to Atlantic City, where he was going to go to an AMA convention, and I forgot to mention, Bill has now moved in with Bob and Ann, and Lois is not happy. He's staying out in Ohio, and it's time for Bob to go to this convention, and he gets on the train to Atlantic City to the AMA convention, and he's never come back sober, and he goes, and he didn't come back sober. He was drunk by the time he got off the train. He got into a bar, drank some. Actually, he checked into the hotel. You know, I've done that, come to think of it. I've gone to conventions and missed about most of it in my room. And then he wound up going back and got into a fight in the bar, and his nurse had to come and get him. And he had surgery to perform 2 days later. And I mentioned he was a proctologist, right? Okay. Well, now he's a shaky proctologist. And he's got to do surgery on this poor man's ass. Now, I don't know the name of this guy, but I would say he probably gave more to AA than Bill and Bob combined. Whoever he was. He's anonymous. But Bob had to operate on this guy. And they drove him to the hospital. And they gave him a sedative and a beer in the parking lot of the hospital just to steady his nerves so he could operate. Now, if you looked out the hospital window and you were waiting for your surgeon, and they actually waited in the parking lot for Bob to settle down, and when he felt he could handle a scalpel or whatever he was going to do for this poor guy, they went up and... He went up and performed the surgery, and they were waiting for Bob to come home later that night. Ann and Bill were, and he didn't come home. Dinner time came around, no Bob, and frankly, they were starting to think that this probably was a bad idea to give him the sedative and the bottle of beer, because they thought it had set off a craving, and he had gone on a binge. And about late at night, somewhere around midnight, they're sitting in Bill's and Bob's house, and the door opens, and there's Bob. And he's standing there, sober as a judge, big smile on his face. They thought he'd come stumbling through that door. And they're shocked. What happened? What happened was, when Bob finished the surgery, he got in the car and he drove all around town making his amends. He did the amends section of the six tenants, and he went around and he was surprised, very surprised, by the reaction of a lot of people, even though he was trembling, like a lot of fear. And when he got home, his fear was gone, and he hadn't had a drink, and he hasn't had a drink since. And that was Dr. Bob's last drink on June 10th, 1935, and we call that the birthday of AA. And it is 2 o'clock, and I had a lot more to say, but I ramble on, I guess, sometimes. So anyway, thank you all for having me and helping me participate in my own sobriety by listening to this, and thanks a lot.